Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our second series on Vietnam. And in this series, we're exploring all aspects. We just had a gentleman talk about his Agent Orange Foundation earlier. We've talked to a lot of vets. And now, today, we're going to talk for this this episode. We're going to talk to Emma Amiad, who was not in Vietnam, but was in the military at that time. Emma is an anti-war activist, and she is also a lesbian. Emma, I have to tell you that when it transcribed your phone to me, or your phone message to me the other day, the transcribes don't come across exactly perfectly. It listed you as Emma Mommy. So that was, you have to take those things with a grain of salt. So I think one of the things, and there's a couple of things to start out with in this whole process, is that being against war and being against the soldiers that fought the war are two different things. For me, in doing these series, I have really grown in appreciation of what the vets went through, what they did. They thought they were doing the right thing, but obviously when you have over 56,000 people killed in a war, and you multiply that times the family members that they had, the brothers, the sisters, the parents, the children, you widened up with a much larger number. So, Emma, let's, and Emma used to live here on Vashon, another thing, and she left us to live in Squim, but Squim has a very nice casino up there, so, you know, if nothing else. But anyhow, really glad to talk to Emma today. And Emma, just kind of tell me a little bit about your background and kind of how you got involved in the military and why you went. You mentioned your parents weren't very happy about it. Go ahead.
Well, that was 1968. You know, I've been thinking, you know, this is over 50 years ago, which is a huge amount of time. The world was a very different place. It was really frightening place at that time. 68 was when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Robert Kennedy was assassinated. The anti-war protests were absolutely out of hand all over the country. The Russians invaded Czechoslovakia. The Tet Offensive in Vietnam shocked our military. We had the Black Power people and the early women's music movement, on television every night. And it was just an amazing year. I had also gone through a personal breakup that was very difficult and some other trauma. And I just wanted to get away from my life. Frankly, it was sort of, if the French Foreign Legion would have taken women, I'd have gone. I mean, I just wanted a total change in my life.
Well, I think you would. I think you would have looked good in one of those French Foreign League.
I think I would have outfits. Actually.
And you know, another thing I saw you mentioned here too was that just really struck me was, you know, that the year the Russians invaded Czechoslovakia, yeah. And yeah. Bingo,
and here we are again.
Here we are. Yeah.
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 It, you know, things just repeat over and over again. But anyway, I was at that time living in Hollywood and. Walked by a recruiting office and sort of looked at the posters, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I need to learn more about what this war is all about. What are we doing there? It's this whole brouhaha about fighting communism. And I really, really just wanted out of the life I had at that point. And so I walked in, and that was the beginning. So I went into basic training in 1968.
And that was, you mentioned here that you just kind of walked into it. And I think when we were that young, we kind of did things like that. That's important. And also, I must have gone through 4 breakups, at least in college. So eventually found my wife who I was married to. Been married.
You're in trouble already. Yeah.
Yeah, I've already, you know. Well, if that was the first time I ever stuck my foot in my mouth, I'd be very, very happy with that. you know, interesting too. You know, you mentioned the other things. Do you think that? And I think this is a fair statement. We talk about racism. I think.
Oh, yeah.
Did you think that Vietnam even heightened that theory? I mean, there were a large number of African Americans and minority students that were sent to Vietnam.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And when I was out of basic, went into training, and then later on was assigned to a regular company. I was amazed at the number of Black and Latinx people that were in the military. And basically, you know, the Army goes through all the poor little towns in the South and just vacuums up all the high school kids because there's no jobs, there's no future. You know, we have done very little to make things better in this 50 years since. And so they say, oh, well, here you're going to get some training and a vocation and a chance to travel. And they sign up and, you know, that hasn't changed. I mean, I came from California. I was in particular communities that were very highly integrated. It never crossed my mind that so much of the rest of the country was so different. And so I was stationed the whole time in the South. And it was just one shock after another. I remember going with a friend, a Black friend, to a restaurant. It took us about 45 minutes of sitting there before we realized we were not going to get served. And we just looked at each other and laughed. It's like, you're kidding me. This is the 20th century. Are you people crazy?
Yes.
There were Black only, White only. Well, it was, they didn't even say Black. They used other words for the segregated bathrooms. So in a way, I have to say that thanks to Harry Truman, one of my favorite historic characters, the Army and the other services were integrated long ago, and so the military at least treated or tried to treat all the soldiers equal, depending, you know, not worrying about race. The fact that a larger number of non-white young men got drafted, I think really had more to do with college deferment than anything else. Every white family that could afford it got their son into school.
Well, I think
that made a big change in what kind of army we had too.
Well, I think that's really true because, you know, I think I made the statement earlier that it when you mentioned about these kids coming out of small towns in the South, I always said like when I lived in Ellensburg, it was like this giant hand came out of the sky and grabbed all these farm kids that had known nothing else, and probably at least 60% of the men that graduated with me in 1966 were planning on going to work with their parents in the fields or with their fathers mm-hmm. and mothers and kind of do the same thing. And instead, like my friend Alan Aronica said, bingo. You know, I graduated in June of 66, and all of a sudden I was in a jungle in Vietnam, and 3 months later. So,
yeah, right. No, it was a lot of things were obvious. Let me tell you a quick story that reminded me
sure.
of. I was enlisted and an officer, so I served half my time as an enlisted person up to the rank of sergeant, and the other half I was a lieutenant. So while I was still enlisted, I was a photojournalist, and there were many adventures as being a photojournalist, which we don't have time to go into. But at one point, I went to a company and did an interview with a commanding officer there, a captain, and his particular group were low IQ. In fact, down to 70.
Wow, that's...
That's pretty low. And I asked him a question. I never published this story. It wouldn't have been published had I typed it up. I said, how many times do you recycle these guys if they don't get through training? He said, 4. So they go through entire basic training 4 times. And he laughed and said, if they finally get shoot and duck, we send them off. So basically, they were taking these people with limited ability intellectually and basically just sending them off to get murdered in Vietnam. That was a massive shock for me.
And I know that, my background is special education. And now we use different terms now.
Of course.
But when I was... when I first started teaching and doing student teaching, I taught in a school that was for the educably mentally retarded, which was people that had IQs 90 and below. And then the kids that were worse than that were considered the trainable mentally retarded. Mm-hmm. And they were considered, I think, 60 IQ or below. Yeah. So you're right. You're talking about... people that at the very least have difficulty in understanding consequences as well as following detailed commands.
Well, they call them cannon fodder, and that's exactly what they were. Mm-hmm. So I would be very surprised if any of those men came home.
Yeah. And tell me what some of the things that you participated in here in the United States when you it sounds like you have a long history of this, Emma. So
well, kind of. You know, I while I was in the military, I with others, I published an anti-war newspaper, which we got out through the various ways we could. I mean, I have many, many stories about how all of that went. But once I got out of the military, I got involved with Vietnam Veterans Against the War and continued those activities on campuses, primarily talking about trying to encourage young men not to go if they had a choice. We did lots of marches. Both anti-war marches and gay rights marches were very nasty. I mean, I had rotten fruit thrown at me, rotten eggs thrown at me in both those kinds of marches. I gave speeches in groups. I mean, I've been giving speeches since I was 5. So that all came pretty easily. But the other piece of that was trying to help returning veterans integrate. And I, for a while, acted as a veterans counselor. I was doing career counseling, but an awful lot of it ended up more personal counseling. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these vets just wanted somebody somewhere to give them a hug and say, it's going to be okay, and what's going on is not your fault, and you did what you thought you were supposed to do. And it was heartbreaking to see what some of those guys went through.
And, you know, a couple statements here that you made that really, really struck very close to me were, you mentioned this other woman who stayed in the military, mm-hmm. and you said she kept quiet about her sexuality and worked her way up to a full colonel before she retired. Mm-hmm. And then the next is what hit me. She says, you say, but she gave up a personal life to do that.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess you shouldn't have to do that.
The whole anti-gay thing was such a crock of shit, really, when you get down to it. It never did any harm. It never created any chaos. They did the don't ask, don't tell thing, which was trying to ease into something. But even now, you know, people in the military say it doesn't matter. It doesn't make a difference. It just really never did. But it was a real bugaboo. I don't know if it was more so with the women in the service, but I kind of think so. A lot of times, if you wouldn't, if you wouldn't go out with a guy, if you wouldn't have sex with a guy, then they just immediately assumed that you were lesbian. They could start that rumor, and then pretty soon you were out of the military, even if you weren't gay. And so many people had to hide so much. I remember one sergeant, it was a kick in the ass. I loved her. She was so great. She made the mistake of double indemnity, so to speak. She was dating an officer, and you don't do that. And she said she, when they would go back into the post from being out on a date somewhere, she had to hide down below the passenger seat. You know, what do you call that? The little place where you put your feet.
Oh, yeah.
Because they didn't dare to show her, because not only was this sort of proving that they were having a lebsbian relationship, but she was enlisted and the girlfriend was an officer. And she used to laugh about having almost permanently red knees because of doing this all the time.
Go ahead.
You know, people tried to make light of it, but it was really a pain in the ass.
Well, you know, Chris Gaynor, and he was the one that gave me your name. And Chris is also gay. And, and when you look at the... you know, we all have visions, and you know there are horrible stereotypes. But when you look at Chris and in the pictures that he took in Vietnam, I mean, he was a fierce warrior, mm-hmm. and nothing should subtract from how hard he worked by the fact and how much he did to protect his fellow soldiers, mm-hmm. because he was gay and. Yeah. I think that things that people don't understand, they tend to reject. And I think, isn't that kind of part of it? I don't know. You're much better.
One of the words that most people don't use is xenophobia. And mm-hmm. people should learn that word, because it means fear of the other. Mm-hmm. And that's what's wrong with everything in our world, in my opinion. We're afraid of what we don't understand or what we don't know. Once people understand or get to know somebody, it changes their attitude. But that's really at the bottom of so much of our social ills, our warfare, everything, is people being afraid of anything that is not what they are or what they perceive themselves to be. And the narrower the person's mind, the less educated they are, the tighter that xenophobia gets. So pretty soon, you know, a white, male, straight person hates another white, male, straight person because of their politics. I mean, that's just horrible. And I think we pretty well have that wrapped up as a species. I don't know. I know a fair amount of background in biology, and I don't think there's another species that's quite so horrible about xenophobia as we are.
Yeah, that's,
but we sure have it.
That's really interesting because, when I think when you, let's say you even take like World War II and Hitler, mm-hmm. Really the in fact, I just read a book on that had how Hitler came to power and the brown shirts mm-hmm. and all that. And basically, it was exactly that. It was xenophobia. It was fear of the other. He did speeches that, mm-hmm. at least in Germany, were, speeches that got to the people. They were going through a recession, and we all like somebody to blame. And he blamed everything on the Jews, on gays, and there were special colored stars for gay people that went to the concentration camps.
Yeah, right.
People that were physically different, like myself, people who were mm-hmm. disabled, were sent because they were the other. And that really resonates with me. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I just think that, it's the boogeyman out there, right?
Always. It really is. And, one of the fun things in life is is to fight against that in a very subtle way. It shocks people, and, I've enjoyed doing that lots of times in my life when I have done unexpected things because no one else would, and all of a sudden, realizing it gives them permission to do it, whatever it might be. And I just look at that and I think, it is such a simple trick to learn. The women's movement, of course, taught a great deal about, defending your own privacy, defending your own, body, all of that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And so many women afraid of doing that. I taught women's studies in a university setting, and I included in a class on women in management, I included a day of physical stuff. I had a very fine woman trainer, a woman who did self-defense, judo, all that kind of stuff. And in the class, finally, what blew me away was nobody would step up and take her on. I mean, she wasn't going to hurt anyone, but she wanted to teach them some basic self-defense against somebody, grabbing them. And finally, I did it. And it was no big deal, and I was happy to do it.
Right.
And then a few of the other women thought, well, okay, I see that, she didn't get hurt. Maybe I'll give it a try.
Well, my daughter, I was going to tell you, my daughter took ballet here on the island, and uh-huh. my daughter then decided she wanted to be, she was the first young woman on the wrestling team here, and she beat several men wrestling, and mm-hmm. one of her friends said, I think your dad came out of the wheelchair when you pinned that guy. and I told my wife, I said, I think my daughter can take care of herself now, so I don't need to be the patriarchal figure and everything. And I think we have just about run out of time here, but Emma, if you get back to the island, I'll buy you lunch. I would love to, I may even give you a call when I get up to Squim if I lose all my money at the casino, then you can buy me lunch up there. So
okay,
love Squim. It's a great place. So you take care, Emma, and
thank
I appreciate it. It's been a wonderful interview. Take care.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Emma. Bye-bye.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.